I absolutely think there's more than one application in how we see this play out in the future, and that we absolutely have an opportunity to speed up the way we respond, to zone in into those early detection phase, but bring the intelligence to that machine. Start looking for other concern indexes or concerning behavior based on an existing pattern, or get ahead of something really breaking out. Ransomware spreading laterally or scans spreading across the network.
This is GamyCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
it's security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Corinne Vermaak, Head of Cybersecurity from Cisco ANZ, and today we're discussing what will AI do for the future of cybersecurity. So Corinne, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, KB.
So on that note, what will AI do for the future of cybersecurity from your point of view? Now, I know it's a big topic. A lot of people have varying opinions, but I'm keen to hear yours.
So I think this is such an opportune time to really debunk a little bit of the myth factors. You know, I feel that the AI conundrum has really taken the technology world by storm, and it's two part. There's a bit of a hype cycle around it, but there's also a bit of ignorance around it. And what does it really mean? Now, as a securist, I am tremendously excited about the new reiteration of artificial intelligence that we're seeing. And what I mean with a new reiteration is the fact that we've now gone from AI just doing predicting and recommending to AI really doing creating. Now, what that means for us in cybersecurity is our systems are now no longer just spotting vulnerable code and knowing that that code is vulnerable based on previous learnings, but it can now create. And that creation means it could actually block. It could learn how operational teams respond to these specific vulnerabilities, and it can go and create a solution. It can recommend and mend and remediate that, which has been in the past a tremendous heavy lifting by our teams. So when we look at this, what we call generative AI, and the ability to interact with AI learning and systems in a natural language format, I think it should excite everybody in our industry, because it's giving us that opportunity not only for the systems to start being part of the solution, but secondly, it also opens up our resource pool, where we now have people that are young, inexperienced, possibly just left or joined the industry, you know, left university or any kind of formal education, and just new starters coming into our industry. And we have the ability through this natural language interface to really ask smart questions, use that thing that KB, you and I have previously talked about, is that critical thinking is so important in this industry, to use that to truly quiz the system. And that gives us the opportunity to augment our resourcing.
Okay, there's a couple of things in there, Corinne, that you said, which was quite interesting. I want to press them a little bit more around the myths that are in AI. Now, I probably will have to buy mainstream media for some of these myths that are out there. But from your perspective, you're obviously at the coalface, you're on the front line speaking to customers. What are some of the myths that people have? And then how can you go about sort of defying some of these myths or debunking them to your sort of phraseology before?
Yes, and I say this with a tremendous smile on my face, because I think the biggest myth in AI is the fact that there's a sense that it's new. It's a new technology. And it is absolutely, absolutely not the case. If you look at the development of predictive algorithms, it dates back to the 1950s. 1951 saw the first academic application of a chessboard software that, you know, Dietrich Prinz built. And it was just an algorithm to predict the next move in a chess game. Now, that in itself debunks the fact that AI is new. What we need to understand is that the way we train machines through firstly supervised machine learning, then you get the sort of AI, the predictive AI models that can predict and recommend the outcome of certain things. What we're seeing now is the leap to the creative AI, so the generative AI. So one of the examples that I want to give with this is 2 years ago, our minds were blown when a fridge got launched that can now order milk when the milk cartridge space within the fridge is empty. Now, all that is a concrete measurement. The milk part is empty, and then the fridge goes into an action to order new milk. It seemed groundbreaking. But what I mean with this creative phase is that with a new reiteration of AI, the fridge can now sense that your usage is up over weekends because you may entertain and you use more milk. And therefore, they can anticipate that you'll run out of milk quicker. Now, that is that creative part where the system and the machines are learning behavior analytics, and that natural behavior patterns that humans are so well known for, and then predicting what comes next. And also they have the ability to create. And I think that was made famous with ChatGPT and all of these generative AI platforms that we saw in the early part of 2023 take media by storm. That's the one massive myth that I would want to debunk. The second of the only two myths that I think we really need to focus on for conversations around technology is the fact that there's going to be a massive loss of employment because of AI. And I truly believe that is not going to be the case. I think we are in an opportune space to realize that. And there's a lot of sayings circulating in the industry around that. People say you won't lose your job to AI, but you may lose your job to somebody using AI. And I think that's the important thing to focus on. We as security practitioners, more specifically, will augment our existing skill. We will streamline our processes. We will also have the opportunity to do things you as a operational practitioner yourself would know that even as short-sighted into history as 4 years ago, how cumbersome a forensic investigation could be, or how cumbersome a real deep breach investigation could be, and how long some of these remediation actions would take. Now, with generative AI in hand, that augmented with the ability of natural language, we have such a tremendous opportunity to now ask the system, what is its recommendation? Immediately pivot back to ask the system, what would be a code remedy? How do you secure this specific piece of code? And then sense checking that without needing to go to our traditional libraries. And that in itself has got a great opportunity to reduce our time to respond and our time to remediate, for instance, in cybersecurity. And then I'm obviously not even talking about the massive values that it brings in vulnerability studies and getting that creative lens on what does this vulnerability actually mean to my estate? And again, saying that we have now the ability to interact with these systems through natural language is the true big leap that we saw in the last 18 months. And that really excites me because while we debunk the myth, it absolutely sets us up for a future using AI to just fight our adversaries.
Yeah, great explanation on that. And I think you are right. And around these myths that people have, especially around the loss of employment, would you say as well, Corinne, it's just going to take time, they say time heals all wounds, for people to maybe feel a bit more comfortable with the sense of, hey, like AI is not going to fully take all of our jobs and it's going to help augment, to your point. Will that just take a matter of years or months or whatever that may look like for this new norm to be a little bit more, apparent in our everyday life? Because if you look at when the internet started, people were afraid of that, right? But now, imagine if we didn't have any internet, like people go nuts pretty quickly. So do you think that as we traverse into the next 5 or so years, it's just going to become normal that we are operating in our job and with AI?
I think even if you look at the AI readiness study that Cisco has done, one of the key indicators in that is the fact that organizations are very aware that they do not have the correct skills. And those skills are spread across different roles. The development of AI, there's a big need for developers to bring this AI platforms into what people already do. For instance, how I deal with my bank will now be augmented through generative AI. And a lot of the questions could be answered through a bot. So that development part is critical for organizations. Then the adoption part has really taken flight. All organizations are looking at how do they help their employees be more productive. And again, we're seeing a lot of that in security. How do we help our teams do more with less quicker? AI is one of those answers, but to adopt that into our current usage and tool set is a skill unto itself. There's absolutely focus on that. And then obviously also talking around all the peripheral skills needed, like project management and change management, to get people on board with all of these AI programs is very, very critical. And this then, lastly, as a thought, spills over into how do we do this responsibly? How do we do this ethically? How do we ensure that the code that we integrate, that the bot that we build are inclusive, and that it's easy to deal with them, and that we don't exclude people from this process, or that we don't apply this technology in any discriminating way? My forward thinking is telling me, or my future eye is saying, that I'm expecting a lot of legal and compliance roles to also pop up to oversee ethical development and adoption of AI. And this ultimately creates a bit of a war in the job market. And I expect people would need to cross-skill a little bit. And again, that's an exciting opportunity to really dive into this AI world and see how that can augment your role and whether that role is in technology or not.
So you said before, getting people on board. Would you say generally, and I'm saying this generally because obviously we're having a general conversation, that people are on board with AI, or would you say people are sort of relatively apprehensive?
I always tongue-in-cheek tell a little tale of actually quite recently. Somebody said to me at a barbecue, what is ChatGPT? And my face as a technologist obviously immediately went into, you and I can't be friends. But what dawned on me after that conversation is that for us as technologists, it's a run of the mill. All of us were playing around with generative AI tools within near immediacy of it being available to consumers. And we saw that a lot of these platforms toppled over post-launch because of just a contention issue, too many people trying to get access to the same platform. However, there's still a large cohort of our general population that's not working with AI and on AI and playing around with it and seeing how it could help them in their day-to-day work. So I would say in the technology spheres, my sense and dealing with customers on a day-to-day basis is there's a very high and mature rate of adoption. Most people can mention or name more than three different platforms that they're interacting with, whether those are language curation platforms like Grammarly or ChatGPT for creating content, drafting things, redrafting or doing copy edits for you, and whether those are platforms like Beautiful.io that actually can create presentations. Most of us are using these tools. However, when you look to slow technology adopters, my sense is that there's still a big group of people that have not adopted it. And as we are aware, in organizations, there's a good mixture of these people. So organizations will absolutely have to bring those non-technology adopters or those non-technology native people along on this journey and help them to understand how these AI tools can help them with productivity. And I think that is a great opportunity. But in the in the technology world, I think there's two things that we have to acknowledge. One, we are early adopters, so we're seeing a lot of it and a lot of exploration happening. That, when we put our cybersecurity hat on, absolutely needs to go with protection, because it is a critical sphere for data leakage, for breaches to occur when you sit with sort of this shadow IT leak kind of environment where employees upload corporate and confidential information into these platforms. So that absolutely is something that needs to be looked at from a cybersecurity point of view. But then the second part that we need to look at is really understanding which of our tools have AI embedded that we may not even be aware of. You would be very aware as a practitioner yourself that just the algorithm around behavior analytics has become quite rife in what we do in cybersecurity. I most recently read about a startup that's got the capability to biometrically identify your keystroke, which effectively they've built an algorithm to log how hard you strike the key, how quickly you strike the keys in between each other when you enter your password, and that becomes a unique fingerprint. And that algorithm can predict whether it's you entering your password or not. Now that is AI at its best. But again, most people aren't aware of these technologies that are out there that can absolutely be used to protect the way we protect our organizations.
So would you say at this stage, Corinne, that there's still a lot of unknowns as much as there's people building frameworks, there's a lot of reporting that's going on to get data to understand a little bit more? But would you say there are still blind spots that exist out there that perhaps we as an industry are missing, would you say?
Absolutely. I think there is still blind spots that because we don't fully unpack the application of these technologies, we will, for the foreseeable future, be in a constant fact-finding, I would say. Our compliance teams will need to look at each application that employees request to use in a unique and specific way with a data governance as well as a security lens. And because these frameworks aren't matured yet, I would say that they would have to do a bit of critical thinking and problem solving whilst they look at these applications to ensure that it is underpinned by good governance. And when you look at what organizations like us, Cisco, prides ourselves on our, for instance, responsible AI usage policy that we developed. And our security and trust organization constantly refines that. One of the things that is very forward thinking in the way we see our policies is we've underpinned the principle in our policies of transparency, which is a really good principle to have when it comes to AI. That effectively requires anybody utilizing AI to disclose that. So when I drafted an email to you, or when one of my engineers concluded a very technical draft document and they had an AI tool sense check that for them or redrafted that, the use of that AI tool in that creative process is disclosed. And I think that's really good because it comes back to ethics. It comes back to owning the work that you did yourself, but also owning where you've augmented your own skills with the AI tool. And that shows maturity for organizations to start looking at the principles that underpin the usage of these tools.
I want to get into the ethics side of things, but before we do that, I want to first explore how smart AI models work.
Oh, that's a great question. And it really goes back to that I mentioned earlier, is how we developed. I'll explain it with a bit of a use case. But when we crossed the Rubicon on supervised machine learning to a predictive AI model, and just wanting to pin a date on that a little bit, predictive AI reached quite a high level of maturity in 2017 already. So again, debunking that myth that it's a new technology, the ability for artificial intelligence models and algorithms to predict an outcome across a vast majority of data sets was really quite mature in 2017 already. And therefore, we already at that stage saw very mature adoption of like the user behavior authentication that I briefly mentioned previously. Understanding whether a user is accessing something that they regularly access, or for instance, is users have got very distinct patterns in how they interact with systems. You know, they log on at a certain time of the morning. They generally have a routine around checking mail and then possibly logging on to systems that they have to work on. And those patterns can absolutely be learned by predictive models based on traffic flows. And that effectively then means that we can pinpoint when a user acts out of behavior pattern. And that, again, as a security practitioner, should raise all kind of alarm bells. You know, when a user logs onto a system that is, for instance, off territory in an unsanctioned country at a time frame that's not normal, like 4 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, that user behavior should immediately prompt high alert. And that's a great example where we see these predictive AI models really helping our defensive teams look at, and now these technologies have been around for quite some time. When we look at that, we also have the ability to step some of that user behavior. One of the things that we do quite well and quite maturely that a lot of people aren't even aware of is with the increase on networks, we actually have the ability to fingerprint a data flow and identify it based on the way the packets are broken up and sent and prioritized. This creates a very specific fingerprint, and it's called encrypted traffic analytics or encrypted threat analytics, where we know how a command and control establishment behaves from a rudimentary switching point of view. And therefore, that becomes a fingerprint that we can identify without decrypting the information. And we can raise alarms around that. Now, again, going back to how does these models work? What we have, for instance, done within Cisco is with our vast amount of threat knowledge that we have through our Talos organization and the amount of threats that we see transverse our networks globally, we were able to firstly identify that fingerprint within encrypted traffic. Then we were able to build those models and train algorithms to identify those models on traffic flows. And effectively, we were able to roll that out across all of our switching equipment, which is a tremendous feat if you think about it. Now it means wherever traffic flows touch a Cisco network or our equipment, we have the ability to identify and fingerprint it against those known anomalies. And we are able to also clean traffic flows like a Google search. And that really puts us in a position to train these models in a very succinct way. The more threats we see, the more of these models we can build, see them as fingerprints. And the more of that we know, the more succinctly we can defend against them in the early stages of that traffic flow behavior. And that's a great example of how these models work. I want to, again, just maybe go back to the fridge analogy and say that we've got to change our mindset around how we look at AI and the training of these models. Because the smarter and more predictive they become, the greater our risk. Because if I go back to the fridge example, where your fridge used to only be able to order milk or alert you that the milk is running out and you could do the ordering part, it now has the ability to order the milk on your behalf, which common sense would tell you it means it's got credit card information, personal home delivery details. And then it takes that step forward in the generative form where it takes your patterns into consideration and now sees that maybe you don't use milk on a Thursday, which means you're not home on a Thursday. and effectively becomes that critical vulnerability to knowing your movements in and around your house. So when we look at an example like that, you could absolutely arrive at the fact that we have to do some heavy lifting in securing these systems all around.
Yeah, great analogy. And when you were talking, I was actually thinking about the milk example, but I just want to press you a little bit more just to set the scene. So you said before intercepting incidents or breaches or whatever it may be at the earliest stage. How much earlier, though, would that be? So, for example, when you spoke about employees logging on in an unsanctioned country, obviously they would log on, you'd get the alert. But if there's the predictive side of it, do you have any sort of indicator on like, oh, Carissa could start to go down that path because, I don't know, just some of the stuff she's doing on her laptop is appearing like a rogue employee, which therefore would might mean that she could do something, or like they could, or it could be anything really. But it's just more. And as a reporting analyst myself, historically, I really value the predictive side of things, especially the analytics. So I'm just then curious to know, like, how good do you sort of envision this sort of getting?
I think that's such a brilliant question, and this goes back to our discussion point earlier, where the human skill and knowledge is still such a critical part of how we apply this. Now, the case that you used where a machine is query, we say in the medical terms, query rogue. There's a suspicion that this machine is running a reconnaissance or there's scans being conducted from this machine. That behavior in itself is then going back to the human decision-making as well as the policies. And us as the practitioners will be responsible to build these policies and playbooks. Now, again, if that is that rogue machine, I wanna stay with the example that you gave. If that's just a rogue machine, the policy can then determine that that machine should be put in a heightened monitoring state. So we think that Carissa is somewhere and she may be traveling and therefore her time frame or login time frames are out of whack. Therefore, let's just put it in monitoring to see whether there's then the next level of what we know in terms of the attack frameworks. Is there data hoarding happening? Is there scans happening? Is there some lateral movement? Is there an attempt to escalate privileges? Those are the things that we can then zone in and focus our efforts on that one machine, which gives us a tremendous opportunity to really catch the perpetrators early in the attack framework. However, if we go to another example, let's say you and I were both around when WannaCry broke out. Let's say your AI or you identify one machine with a worm-like virus like WannaCry that has this tremendous spreading capability in a short amount of time. When you identify or when the system identifies that, you can immediately give instruction that wherever the AI systems or wherever the algorithms detect that, to quarantine those devices and possibly shut them down. Now, through MDM capabilities and how we architect our security platforms, we have the ability to do this. And that's where our speed to response will be tremendously faster through AI, because I can now immediately identify that this is something that runs the potential of breaking out on my network and taking down a lot of devices. I can now, through natural language, within the foreseeable future, give an instruction to say, quarantine everything where you see this concern index. Now, that we have not been able to do in the past. And that's a great example, as you could think of, where we could absolutely use these artificial intelligence engines and software to speed up our efficiency in a sort of emergency environment. So I absolutely think there's more than one application in how we see this play out in the future, and that we absolutely have an opportunity to speed up the way we respond, to zone in into those early detection phase, but bring the intelligence to that machine. Start looking for other concern indexes or concerning behavior based on an existing pattern, and or get ahead of something really breaking out, ransomware spreading laterally or scans spreading across the network. And those are the things that we could build into an automated response with these platforms, and the platforms can respond and then send the alert after the fact. It's much easier to go and unlock machines that was locked by the system versus having something run rampant on your network.
So just to summarize that a little bit more with that example, Corinne, so what you're saying is that with everything you just talked about at length could be perhaps the difference between a major incident, ransomware, et cetera, because there's that window of time, whether it's through the heightened monitoring, the alert that's come a little bit earlier, et cetera, to be able to respond faster than perhaps before.
Absolutely. And with these machine models, we can spot things that I want to say the human eye can't. And I want to just give you a quick example of that. When you build a model to understand the general download behavior patterns of a user, you can use that as a fingerprint to immediately identify when a device is data hoarding. Now, you and I would both know, and our audience would know, that data hoarding precedes data exfiltration. And that's what we're trying to fight against. So if we have the ability through network visibility tools to identify when a device or a user or a identity of a user is downloading more than their regular pattern, and we can then immediately go and investigate that further. And that precedes that data exfiltration step. And the system could do that. You would have to have a tremendously large SOC to even kick off an investigation around the behavior flows and the amount of data people download, where a system can just learn the behaviors over time and realize that a great example is that this person works in finance and at the end of the month, they download heaps of information. So once the system has observed that end of the month cycle, they will build that into the model and continue that as the normal baseline, which is a heavy lifting for any human analyst.
So with that in mind, do you envision that breaches, incidents will start to reduce then? If just in a perfect world, every single organization on the planet is using smart AI, all this predictive analytics, will the breaches and incidents start to decline then, would you say? Or is there going to be another problem that arises?
So I think, sticking with your language around the perfect world, we should be seeing that a lot of our network incidents could be minimized, or the early diagnostics or the early detection on these events should improve our high fidelity cases or reduce our high fidelity cases. Now, saying that, I have to caveat that unfortunately, our offenders are weaponizing AI against us as quickly as we are using it in defense. However, I also have to say that we have observed over the last 18 months a big pivot towards organized, low technology scamming. And that really goes back to that email threat vector and blocking that early entry through multi-factor authentication, doing those basics really well, and then obviously bolstering those basic hygiene efforts with AI like user behavior analytics and keystroke monitoring when you enter your password to use it as a third and fourth level of authentication. Because we're seeing that these, I want to say, low-level scams, impersonations, and with the use of AI, super, super deep fakes is becoming a true concern, specifically when you look at the financial industry. The insurance industry are seeing a lot of these scams increase through the use of AI. Therefore, even though I'm an ever optimist and I'm a true believer that AI is going to reduce a lot of our network-based attacks, I think it is a grand opportunity to also ensure that we use AI to protect against the vectors that we know there's an increase in attacks. And those are the more, I want to say, low-tech attacks, scams, and email compromises that come through to just a tired user that clicks on a link. And it's one of those that we've been talking around for maybe more than a decade.
So I want to flip back now to discuss the ethical side of AI. You say that AI must be ethical from the start. So then I'm curious to know, and maybe if you could define ethical, and then where's the start?
Yes, so great question. Ethics is one of the oldest disciplines. And I actually most recently presented a seminar on that. I found when I did my research for that what we're expecting in this AI ethic world is not vastly different from what we expect from ethics as a whole. I think the base assumption in it is that it is fair, that it is equitable, and that it is in no way malice against humanity. And I think that is obviously wholly oversimplifying the ethical values that we need to underpin these AI structures with. Now then that pivots us to the second part of your question, but where does it start? And that's a really good question, because I think like we've seen model legislation force us to be secure by design, taking that security lens earlier in the development process, my sense is when it comes to artificial intelligence that ethical lens needs to be really early in the development. And that goes back to my example of adoption and building it into what we do. When we use AI in any way, shape, or form, whether it's a voice responding on an IVR, a bot that somebody can speak to, we need to ensure that the application of that is inclusive, that it is not to the detriment of anybody, that it is unbiased. We've seen heaps of legal research being done around, for instance, the ethical platform that some of the US police forces use in their chest cams to identify and alert a responding police officer to whether somebody has got a pre-existing criminal record. Now, some people may say, but what does ethics have to do with that? What the research found is that the amount of violence that the responding officer use in some of these arrests escalate when they are made aware of somebody's previous criminal convictions. Now, that in its sense is not fair, because if that is a rehabilitated criminal that is in the wrong spot at the wrong time, to be met by excessive violence could be frowned upon by society. Now, that is one of the examples. When we look at self-driving cars, ensuring that a self-driving car doesn't see a small child as an animal is really critical when it comes to the development of the software. And these are but a few examples. When you look at the development of filters and skin tones and emojis and these kind of things, we want to ensure that how we develop these platforms and all of these, that they are inclusive and that they aren't harmful in any way to anybody that may use it. And that really comes to the really beginning days of developing or integrating these technologies when we use them. And that goes back to, I think, companies need to start with developing their AI frameworks. And I'm happy to share some of what we're doing within Cisco, because we really pride ourselves on how we see the ethical development of AI throughout all of our tools. And all of our technology has got AI embedded in them somewhere. Even if you look at some of our speech tools and our collaboration tools, we have the ability to drown out collateral noises that are not voices, which means a barking dog in the background in a home office is no longer an issue. And that's all done via AI. Now, as we develop these things, we ensure that they are done ethically, that they are inclusive, and that they do not harm anybody. And again, the use of them are disclosed at any point of time. So these are some of the base guidelines that I would say and the process couldn't be earlier as day dot.
As you were talking examples, I was thinking, oh, self-driving cars, and then you literally said it. So I want to maybe, I'm curious about that just as an example. And I remember doing an interview about this a few years ago, actually. But just say you're driving along and there's an accident, and I know it's going to be a bit of a basic accident, and just say there's a cat or a dog, you have to swerve. How does the ethics then sort of come into it around, well, someone may be hit in this, who's it going to be? Is that going to be really hard to determine? Because again, it's not a black and white answer. There are variables, there are factors into it. Is that where you think there is going to be arguments across to say, well, actually, I like cats more, so forget the dog, and then equally vice versa? So how's that then going to play out through ethics? Is it going to create more consternation than we already have around the whole AI hype cycle?
Now, we have spent hundreds and hundreds of years refining our legal models around the reasonability test. And when you look at that, that is a great parallel or analogy to use when it comes to the AI decision making. If that car is driven by a human and for some reason they land up in court because they unfortunately harmed somebody's cat or dog, whichever they decided, whichever side, they are going to have to recount for what was their decision-making criteria in the circumstances. It could have been that there was a small child on the dog side, and to avoid the child, they had to swerve towards the cat side. There was a solid pole and they had a minor in the car on the cat side, so they had to swerve towards the dog side. And these are examples where, you know, you have the ability to recount that decision-making points that you had in under consideration. And then the court applies something that they call the reasonable person test. And the reasonable person test effectively says that, would somebody with your skills and knowledge in the same circumstances behave in a similar manner? And if a reasonable person would have behaved in a similar manner, it is considered to be reasonably fair or fair in those circumstances. Now, that is what we look at when we look at the ethical behavior of AI. But now, because this is a trained algorithm, and we don't necessarily can recount always how they arrived at a certain decision, that now becomes an ethical conundrum, because we need to have the ability to either keep the developer accountable, keep the driver accountable that was sitting behind the self-driving car for not taking control over. And that's then where it becomes really tricky. So when we look at AI development, we as society and as practitioners in these fields need to absolutely drive our focus so that these trained algorithms behave in a manner that is acceptable and fair, and that we can then substantiate that manner and those decision-making protocols. And that's why the testing of these algorithms are so critical. And again, back to your self-driving car example, all of the developers across the world that works on self-driving car have got subjects and copious amounts of test dummies and animals and all kinds of road scenarios to put that algorithm under pressure, because that's effectively when the decision-making becomes critical. And once under pressure, that decision-making gets tested in different scenarios and also in a repetitive manner. Will the car behave the same consistently under the same set of circumstances? And how much change in the circumstances then moves the car's algorithm to make a different decision? And those things need to be tested in an ongoing way to ensure that these self-driving cars is a great example, and self-driving buses is now an absolute reality if you look at where, for instance, is going with their buses throughout Europe. Now you not only have one, two, or maybe four passengers at the realm of an algorithm, you may have seen young school children heading to class. That's a massive responsibility to put on an algorithm, and the developers need to ensure that there's no bias in the system, that the system can continuously and consistently behave in the right manner, and do it under pressure.
Wow, that's wild. Do you envision, though, that things could go rogue, though? Because, I mean, like, even today, we had a little bit of technical difficulties on this platform, and that's not a whole bus driving around 60 children. Like, that is crazy that we're all sort of, to some degree, putting our faith in an algorithm and things do go wrong. So are you ever worried about that? Because again, like when it comes to, and I mean, I've worked in a bank myself. I always used to say, like, when someone loses money, okay, that's annoying and that's bad, but we can give it back. When you're talking about life or death, you can't get your life back.
So I want to start this answer by really caveating it. And I always say it to everybody that knows me, that I am the ever optimist. And as an early technology adopter, I can't wait for self-driving cars that is 100% autonomous, because I think that once the algorithms are tested and pressure tested correctly, the margin for error is less. And I want to give maybe a silly example. A car's algorithm cannot drop their mobile phone on the floor and reach to pick it up and swerve to another lane. A self-driving car can technically be programmed not to exceed the safe speeding limit. A self-driving car can immediately come to a halt or slow down the speed when tires deflate, which an astute driver may not even pick up, or a young driver, a P-plater, may not even be aware that they're driving with a flat tire. Those are the kind of things that excites me about AI. But going back to your question about can it go rogue? Absolutely. I think, and we are always, as security practitioners, aware of one, the vulnerabilities of all systems. And anybody that develops AI systems will build and have to build a very, very robust security architecture regime and framework around how do they secure these platforms from external attacks. What you don't want is to have your car drive at 110 kilometers on a freeway, and then somebody hacks the system and it switches the car off altogether, and you've got a free moving 2-ton vehicle at 110 kilometers per hour. That we don't want, obviously. However, I do sense and I see with the high level of inspection, as well as the high level of recall cost for all things AI. And I'm not only talking about self-driving cars, I'm talking about smart fridges and all of the smart devices that we have in and around us. For any of these manufacturers to recall a faulty device is really quite a costly exercise. Now, that effectively means that the base embedded code needs to be critically secured and needs to be quality tested at a very, very high level. So my sense is that the manufacturers of these devices and or software and systems are making a tremendous amount of effort to ensure that they get it right the first time, and that if there are any tweaks required or bug fixes, that they are small enough to be done via a software update. And that is where the manufacturers then put it in the hand of the operator. And it becomes our responsibility to ensure that these devices are updated regularly, that they are patched well, and that we operate them within the usage frameworks. Because then it's then, as they say, when all else fails, refer to the manual. It is then when we are jointly with the manufacturer become responsible users of these AI systems, tools, and devices.
So, Karine, I'm conscious of time, but really quickly, do you have any closing comments or final thoughts to leave our audience with today?
Oh, yes. I am tremendously excited about what AI is going to do for our industry. I want to really invite your audience to play around with some of the tools and to see how and understand which of the tools that they're working with already has got some of these capabilities, and to sharpen the blade. Every day is a school day, and we have a tremendous opportunity to learn this new world of artificial intelligence and how it can really help us do our job on a day-to-day basis. So I would really want to invite your audience to go and dapple with all of these toys. You can't really break most of them, and see how you can adopt some of these to improve your own productivity and your team's productivity, because I think it's such an opportune time for people to cross-skill a little bit.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This episode is brought to you by Mercsec, your smarter route to security talent. Mercsec's executive search has helped enterprise organizations find the right people from around the world since 2012. Their on-demand talent acquisition team helps startups and mid-sized businesses scale faster and more efficiently. Find out more at mercsec.com today.